Cool, yeah. All right. Sounds like everything's working. My levels are up. Record is on. And I think we're good.
All right.
Welcome back to Street PX. This is 2016, and we're going to be opening up the next season with a bang. I got my good friend and co-host,
Jim Watkins.
Hello, folks. How you doing?
How you doing, buddy?
All right, man.
How's the new year been treating you?
So far, so good, man. So far? It's been pretty busy. Yeah?
Yeah. You been out shooting a whole lot?
I have. In the rain. I love the rain.
Oh, it's California's finally got rain again.
Yeah.
It actually feels alien.
Yes, it does.
But then we also had the show here recently, Through the Lens Part 2.
That's right. It was fantastic. You know, kudos to Christy Lewis putting together that show. A lot of street photography, a lot of landscape photography, cityscapes, just beautiful photography from photographers around the area. So, man.
Yeah, fantastic. On this go, she actually had, what, over 300 people arrive this time,
right? That's right, yeah. In Oakland and at the Parliament.
Shoulder to shoulder. And the amount of work was impressive, too, just seeing it all on the wall and how she was able to get it all organized up there.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, she does a great job.
Impressive.
And she is announcing a show. As a matter of fact, she announced it earlier this week. So look forward to it. I think it's
coming 23rd.
April 23rd. Yes.
Yep. That'll be the third annual, I guess.
That's right.
Are we going to be calling it an annual or
quarter annual, whatever, however she's going to do it, just whenever she wants to do it, I'm going to be there.
Yeah. Yeah. This thing's just growing more and more every time. And I'm happy to be there watching it happen.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Well, and we got a special one for you today. We actually have another local boy, but at the same time, a native from Chicago, just like Jim and myself. We got Scott Strazanti.
Hey, how's it going? Good to be here.
Yeah. Oh, man. Welcome, man.
Ah, it's great to be here.
Welcome to the studio. Scott, like I said, comes to us originally from Chicago, south side. Is that what you said?
Far southeast corner of the city.
Well, cool. Well, go ahead and tell the people a little bit about yourself, and we'll get to know you a little better.
Oh, yeah. I grew up in a very industrial corner of Chicago. My dad was a tire dealer, so I went to college to take over his tire business and absolutely did not want to do that. And So was a business major in college and just kind of fell into photography, and it just kind of was a fluke. I was more of a sports fan as a kid, and so I had Sports Illustrated. Actually, on one side of my bedroom, I had all these great sports photos by Walter Yost and Neil Leifer, and on the other side, I had my Farrah Fawcett poster and, you know, the swimsuit issues. So I, you know, kind of had both sides of it. So I never, ever thought I'd be a photographer, but I love sports. So I started bringing my dad's camera to sporting events in Chicago, White Sox games and Bears games. And that just kind of evolved into, you know, being a hobby. And when I got to college, I worked very little bit for the school paper, but I mostly just took pictures of girls at frat parties, you know, and just kind of tried to use it to pick up girls. Didn't work. And then halfway through college, I saw a gallery show of work by this photographer named Paul Giroux, who was at the Tribune at the time, Chicago Tribune. And I seriously just had a lightning bolt moment. I was like, this is what I want to do. And my school had no photo classes, so I just became an art major and then just learned on the job. And I fell into a part-time job at a small paper in the community I grew up in when I got out of college and just learned by making mistakes. Went from a smaller paper to a bigger paper to the Chicago Tribune. And then about 2 years ago, I met Judy Walgren, who was the director of photography at the Chronicle then. She just recently left. And she pretty much said, hey, Scott, how do you like Chicago? And I'm like, it's okay. It's really cold. It's like, you want to come work for me in San Francisco? I'm like, okay. You know, and that was it. And then, you know, pretty much a couple months later, packed up. My daughter's at UCLA. She's a junior. And I brought my son, dragged him out of high school, and we came to the Bay Area and just love it. And, you know, I started doing street photography probably about 5-6 years ago. I never really thought of street photography as really kind of something I would do. I was so newspaperish. I was like, what's the point? You know, there's no news value to it. you know, and so it was kind of weird. And I just remember walking down the street and just seeing these great moments and me kind of thinking, well, why would I photograph that? The newspaper won't run that. Why would they run a photo of someone smoking in this beautiful shaft of light? You know, it just didn't seem to have any news value to it. But then, you know, I just kind of, you know, got really tired of showing up at an event and having people know they're being photographed, you know, and everyone changes how they act when they know they're being photographed. Mm-hmm. And I was just tired of seeing people change what they were doing, because I had a camera in the room. And then I just started doing street photography with my big bulky 35 millimeter. And I always, you know, from day one doing street photography, I did a shooting from the hip. You know, I never was one of those people who, you know, kind of stopped and composed. I always kind of shot from the hip. And, I think I developed that style of shooting children over the years because I don't like camera awareness and I don't like people staring at the camera. So I always would kind of start when kids were around, I would, you know, kind of shoot, you know, from a lower angle. And I got really good at kind of controlling the frame.
Yeah.
Just from practice. And so when I started doing street photography, you know, I guess maybe because I'm a kind of a timid guy and I also don't want a moment ruined, that I just started kind of, you know, shooting that way. And, you know, I think people who don't do street photography, maybe some who do, think that that's a cop-out, that that's kind of cheating, you know, but for me, it's just kind of the way I do it. And, it's just amazing. You can just kind of walk into a moment and make photographs. And even with the big Canon I used to shoot with, people still would not know they were being photographed because the camera wasn't to my eye. You know, they would maybe look down and they would just kind of, oh, I don't know what that was about, and kind of move on. But then in about 2010, my daughter was and I went to visit George Washington University in D.C. For a college visit. And she had an iPhone at the time and I didn't. I had a company issued BlackBerry. And
it was a great camera for you.
Oh, it was, man. Fabulous camera on that BlackBerry. 3 pixels, I think. You know, and so I think I saw Damon Winter, who I think at that time, maybe he was in Dallas. I can't remember. Maybe he was in the New York Times at that point. You know, he did this photo story in Afghanistan with Hipstamatic and it won an award and it was very controversial in the photojournalism community. You know, someone had used, you know, a filtered system to make photographs and then it was, you know, cause the photojournalism community is really kind of, yeah, they're like everything. It has to be the old way no matter what, you know,
mm-hmm. tradition. Yeah.
And so Damon kind of broke that kind of taboo of using mobile photography. So I saw that. And so I borrowed my daughter's iPhone. I downloaded the Hipstamatic app and I just started walking around DC taking pictures with the iPhone and I loved it. I just loved the look of it. I loved the square format. I just loved kind of the depth of field. It was like super. A lot of depth of field, but also compressed. And mm-hmm. it was like a wide angle telephoto. It was just this kind of look that I can't really do with my big camera. And so I just started using Hipstamatic and I'm a creature of habit. So just for the last 4 or 5 years, I mostly do black and white with Hipstamatic, same lens combination, John S lens with, Black Keys super grain film. And so it's like super vignette-y and it's really contrasty, but I really like the look of it. And so now I probably every day or two, I will go out for an hour to walk in San Francisco, kind of usually the same pattern. I leave the Chronicle, like, you know, go to Market and I go down Powell. I walk through Chinatown. I go down to, Fisherman's Wharf. You know, sometimes I'll just go straight down Market to the Embarcadero and it's kind of the same path all the time. Every once in a while, I'll go into the Mission. But most of the time, I kind of have to stay near the paper.
Right. It's a great area to be working out of.
Yeah, but it's great, especially, you know, and then I don't work too much in the Tenderloin. I'm not really interested in like homeless people laying on the street. It's just not for me. Like, I like just everyday people, like the mix of businessmen and tourists. And I really like tourists a lot. And also, you know, when you're around tourists, you know, everyone's taking photographs. So you can blend in even more.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah. But still, with the iPhone, I could literally walk up to someone, stand next to them for 5 minutes at the bus stop and take 50 photos and they don't know it at all. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I use Instagram to kind of put it out there and Facebook, and I'm kind of a social media whore. So it's, you know, always throwing stuff out there. And now with the, you know, the Chronicle also wants us to do a lot of social media. But I think they wanted a little more straightforward kind of, I think they really would prefer us using our big cameras and then putting that on Instagram.
Yeah.
Where for me, Instagram is all about mobile photography. It's not about shooting with, you know, a 1DX and then putting it on Instagram. For me, it's all about that instant stream of consciousness, like an artist sketching on a napkin. That's what street photography is to me. It's not, this really kind of permanent, thing that I'm trying to create. For me, it's just this kind of casual, you know, how I see life on a day-to-day basis. And a lot of people see some of my work and they're like, oh man, don't you wish you'd taken that with a real camera? I'm like, well, no, because
this is a real camera.
Yeah, it's communicating. You know, more people are seeing this than they see my newspaper work. It's, you know, definitely, it's probably, you know, my favorite thing to do in photography now.
You know? The velocity in which you can get it out too. I mean, yeah, you have your cameras with Wi-Fi and so forth that you can quickly link, but you said with yourself a while ago, creature of habit, you know, when you think about a style or when it comes to the top 10 tips list for street photography, they always say, choose a lens or a camera and stick with it. That way you can develop yourself a style and people can recognize it. Was it Jason Martini out of Chicago was an iPhone street photographer as well.
Yeah.
Phenomenal one. And once you get in the groove and it works for you, there'll be a lot of naysayers saying, oh, you know, the iPhone's not a real camera. It's got a lens. It captures imagery. It's printable. That seems like a camera to me.
Yeah, I agree.
We wanted to kind of drill down into some of that, though. But
yeah, I was going to say, speaking of style, you said you use the Hipstamatic when you do the Instagram, when you post on Instagram.
Right.
And I noticed your style. I love it. It's very moody. It's you know, like you said, you work with shadows and light, and it's almost like a film noir kind of cinematic kind of thing to it. Very, you know, like you said, very random, very in the moment. And I'm loving that style. I love it.
There's a photographer, Gregory Crutzen, who does these really large scale, orchestrated, cinematic images where he will basically film a movie in one scene, basically. And I saw him speak and he said that his favorite photographs are the intersection of beauty and sadness. And for me, I was just like, yes, you know, that's exactly what I like. And I'm an optimist. I'm a very happy person. You know, I have no sadness in my life. I'm not depressed. I've been incredibly blessed in everything I've done. But I love sad things. I love sad music. I love sad movies. Mm-hmm. I love sad photographs. I always am looking for emotion in my photographs. And it seems like in my street photography, that emotion is always kind of depressing and sad.
Yeah.
You know, my girlfriend is like, I don't get it. Can't you take photos of puppies?
Well, you do have cat pictures.
Yeah, you're right.
You know,
I do have cats.
To balance it out.
Yeah.
But sadness is one of the more powerful emotions
Oh, yeah.
That you're going to derive. I mean, it's going to be one of the most inspiring type of emotions, one of the most pushing somebody to do something they might not want to.
Right. No, it's like I think the purpose of photography is to connect with people. It's like to look at a photograph and feel something. And I think that's the goal. And, you know, that's why. But it's also not something I'm consciously thinking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you guys are photographers. You know, most of the time, your best photographs, you're not even thinking. You know, it's just kind of.
Just pushing that button.
Yeah. Just kind of. And then whatever style I have or whatever my messages is all in the editing, you know, when I'm shooting, I'm shooting and I really am not thinking what I'm shooting except for just kind of this very organic feeling that it's a good photograph or it's the right moment. But you know, later is when I kind of editing is when you kind of put what you have to say out there.
Yeah. I agree.
Now, you were saying about the editing. I just wanted a really quick question. For your street photography, I know you'll do editing to kind of getting that gritty, kind of dark vignetting, really, really pushing the contrast. With your journalism work, is that more of a streamlined system? It's shoot, send out, and then they post, or do you do post-processing?
Yeah, I do most of the posting. So when I do my street photography, I'm usually putting stuff on Instagram within a minute or two when I take it, you know, so it's not where I take 50 photos and I go back and I carefully edit them. I just kind of like, oh, I like that when I put it up, you know, every once in a while I'll be like, oh, wait, that's not so good. And I might delete it later.
Yeah.
But most of the time for me, Instagram is just this instant thing, where my newspaper photography is more, you know, I will shoot an assignment. we occasionally have to transmit during an assignment, but most of the time I shoot the entire assignment, then I go back and then I edit everything and then I put in the photos I like. And it's weird. It's like when I'm shooting for myself, I'm much freer. I'm more creative. When I'm shooting for the newspaper, sometimes I tend to not be as creative and I'm aware of it. And I really, it's hard for me to kind of pull back. I feel like in my newspaper work, I'm trying to have it be accessible to a wide range of an audience where I want like a photo student and a grandmother to both like it, you know, and I want people who have no photo IQ to the people who have the greatest photo IQ to like photography. So I guess my newspaper work, I aim to be more accessible where my street photography is just for me. Mm-hmm. You know, when people critique my street photography, I don't care because I'm shooting it for myself. You know, I'm not shooting it for the world. I do put it out there for the world because I like attention, but it's definitely something where my street photography is how I see the world.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, there's no artifice to it. Where my newspaper work, I think it's more sanitized, you know, just because it's going through the newspaper and it can't be, you know, I guess it could be edgy. I don't know. I think that's all in my head and I'm probably never will work truly through that. But that's why I think I like the street photography because it's my voice totally.
Mm-hmm. I just want to step back because you talked about emotion earlier. You know, Brian Sokolowski, remember?
Sure.
Yeah, Brian. He mentioned a few years ago that street photography should be about emotion. And at the time, I really didn't get it. You know, I would say, oh, it doesn't have to be about emotion. I mean, you know, you can have somebody just walking down the street and everything, you know, no emotion shown. I didn't get it. But now that I've become more experienced in it, I can see what he was talking about. I get it now. There's an emotion. I mean, maybe the emotion is not in the image, but maybe the viewer feels something. And that's when I was going through your Instagram photos and I saw that emotion in there that you were just talking about. And even in your documentaries. Now, you know, I really like that.
I appreciate that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's how to make a photograph last. You know, there's a lot of photographs I'll see and I'm like, oh, that's beautiful. But then it's gone, you know, like I don't ever think of it again. But you can put a photograph up there, it makes me feel something that draws me in, that's layered, that I can discover new things 5 minutes after I first saw it. Those are the photographs I love, the ones that are complicated, but also simple at the same time. And so those are the photos I'm drawn to. And so that is definitely something that I strive to put out there. And, mm-hmm. And some days you go out there and you just don't make anything, you know,
and then
some days like it just comes in bunches. So it's really kind of interesting how the whole thing works. But yeah, it's all about emotion. But the thing is, if I wanted likes, I would just silhouette everything, you know, it's just like, everyone loves a silhouette. Like there's certain photos I know I'm going to put up there to get a lot of likes. You know, I can easily just, you know, shoot a shadow photo and I know, oh, it's going to get so many likes, but for me, it's going to be like,
Yeah.
So I guess on those needy days, I'll put some shadows or silhouettes out there, but most of the time, you know, I almost kind of think my best photos have the least likes, you know?
Yeah.
That's how I feel sometimes a lot too, is I'll have a series of shots that I pulled from that day, get home, I'm looking through them, and there's always one that I'm like, oh, this was it. I post all of them up, and that one gets like 2 likes.
Yeah.
But we all have our own favorites. We all have our own sense of style and sense of what makes a great photo that other people are going to completely see differently. Because that image, I've got an image here that James purchased from me at the show, that I forgot about shooting a year or two ago because it just kind of fell into the fold. And only recently did I pick it up and pull it out. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. This is actually a really good image because it fell amongst a bunch of other ones that nobody really paid too much mind to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like I also feel sometimes like I'm shooting so much that I feel like I'm Gary Winogrand. I forget to look at my photographs.
Yeah.
Like I'm doing this gallery show in May in Toronto on Instagram sports photos. And so I just went back through every single Instagram or every single iPhone photo I've taken in the last 4 or 5 years. And it was amazing. Like there were so many images I never even looked at. It was just crazy.
Where did these come
from?
Yeah,
like I felt like I didn't take them, you know? Uh-huh. It was just like I felt like there was someone else's photography somehow got put in there. And so that's really interesting. It's like sometimes I feel like street photography for me is just the process of it. It's almost not even like
it's the meditation.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
creating it is what I like and not even looking at it sometimes. You know, it's just crazy.
Wow. I actually found an 8 gig card the other day in my car that I must have pulled out of my camera as I was switching it and it fell between the seat. I pull it out, I get inside, it's half full. It's like 4 gigabytes, so 200-300 pictures. never seen them before. Wow. Like that was from a 2 or 3 hour segment of my walk that was just disappeared from my mind, forgot about, and then I come back and see them. But actually, as a side note, in the last show we were talking about, I was thinking about switching to film. And that is something that I noticed with losing that card is it got to sit and what's the word? How do they put it? Simmer
or percolate, ruminate.
Yeah. And you come back to it, you forget it, you don't have that connection that you once did. Now it's completely new to you.
Yeah, because I think, you know, when you make a photograph, you're bringing all 360 degrees of your experience. Mm-hmm. You know, and so sometimes you apply that onto the photograph, so it seems better to you than other people because they weren't there.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so, like, when you can get that experience into that frame, that's when you're really successful. When you can make people feel everything around you, that happens maybe 2 or 3 times a year. You know?
Oh, yeah. So
it's definitely.
And maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe.
I think that picture we were talking about that we feel is our favorite from the grouping and nobody else really seems to appreciate, but you just said it's like you have that 360 degree sense. You are looking at the picture, remembering the smell, the sound, the reaction or pre-reaction.
How hard it was to make that image.
Yeah. Yep. And you're looking at it thinking all these things and you show it to somebody and they have no idea about any of that.
Right. Yeah. So?
Yeah, exactly. That's well and good.
Now, we would be remiss if we didn't mention the fact that this man has won a Pulitzer Prize.
Yes.
We have to bring
we
that
We have to
up.
Bring that
Sorry.
In.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that.
No, yeah. No.
But it's kind of like...
It's a co-recipient with
so
the Chicago
like,
Tribune.
Like, I always kind of consider it like it's not a real Pulitzer because I was... You know, it is. It was a great piece of journalism. So it was back in early 2000s in Chicago. I was part of a team that did a story on defective toys. My part of it I did was on, do you remember those little magnetic toys that kids would play with and they would kind of cling together? They were like magnetic balls. I don't know if you, maybe.
They would make different designs, like a perfect looking triangle.
Right. Yeah. So like you just get this whole big thing and it would have like little magnetic pieces and you could build things.
Magnetic erector set.
And so what would happen is kids would swallow these things. And the magnetics would kind of stick together in their intestines. And like some kids died from it because they would swallow these magnets and they would kind of all bind up their intestines. And so basically this story we did at the Chicago Tribune kind of exposed that. And also a lot of it was on defective cribs. So, it was spearheaded by a writer, Patricia Callahan. And she was the one who gets all the credit. And I just kind of documented it. You know, I made the photographs. They weren't like any photographs that I even have in my portfolio anymore. They were good, solid photojournalism, but it was the story really that was what was good and the result of it. You know, it changed legislation. It, you know, these toys aren't made anymore. And so when it comes down to it, as a newspaper photographer, that's your goal is to change life for the better.
Yes.
It rarely happens. So I was part of a Team Pulitzer and for a while I didn't really put it on my resume because it, you know, I consider Pulitzer like, you know, just like the great single images of the past, you know?
Yeah.
And so, but it is, it was, you know, I guess I truly did win a Pulitzer, but I don't put it out there. I'm more proud of other things, you know, other awards that I've won, but Pulitzer definitely resonates with the world and it's more of a kind of a catch thing. So, you know,
has a surreal feeling to it. It's not,
it's cool.
It's like I have it, but I don't feel like it, but I do.
Yeah. I would love to like win a Spot News or feature a Pulitzer someday. Then I kind of would feel like they just had this big gathering of people win photo Pulitzers in DC the other day. And I was jealous. I was sitting there. Damn. I wish I had one of those. You know, I could be there, you know, cause I'm a better photographer than all of them.
Every one of you. But beyond that, you've been 11-time Illinois Photographer of the Year, National Photographer of the Year, runner-up National Photographer of the Year.
Yeah, so those are the ones I'm more proud of because that is like my work. It's all my work and, you know, it's judged by my peers. Like the Pulitzer is really an interesting judging thing too. It's more of a it's more like the story is more important than the photographs sometimes. But still, it's all great work and, you know, anything that kind of pushes the craft forward is good. So I'm not really that jealous of it, but
you're looking to win Wimbledon, not World Series.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Yeah. So, but it's interesting. It's like when I was younger, I wanted to make every great photograph and I was jealous of every other good photographer. And I think now with age and maturity, I can appreciate other good work now. And it's doesn't make me less of a photographer because someone else is better or really good. So it's like there is a lot of, you know, in any kind of artistic endeavor, I think it's based on some sort of insecurity and, I was the youngest of 3 children and my parents didn't pay enough attention to me. So I think that's why I'm a photographer because I love having something to show people. I love people, you know, commenting on something I created. I could not survive in a 9-to-5 job pushing papers because I need to be creating something. And I, you know, yeah. And I think a lot of it, and I think most artists, if they were honest with themselves, would say this, it's based on their need, to be recognized. It's based on their need to, kind of be validated in what they do. And, you know, maybe there are some really pure-hearted artists out there who are doing it just for, you know, humanity's sake or whatever. But no, I think, you know, all of us, our best qualities are kind of sometimes based on things that aren't that pretty. But, you know, I don't want to turn this into the psychology podcast.
No, that's fine because you're talking about me when you're saying this too. You know, I'm the same way.
Yeah.
You know, I'm social media, you know, I put it up, you know, sometimes you get validation and hey, you know. Yeah. You like it.
Every once in a while, something will catch fire.
Yeah.
And usually the image that you don't expect.
Exactly.
Let's come back around to Common Ground.
Yes.
That's what I was really wanting to look into. That is, I just need to say that is an amazing project. Whenever you think about projects that photographers have put together, emphasis on the past, like this isn't ongoing. This one, how long have you been working on this now?
It's in its 22nd year now. So I started in May of 1994.
And tell us a little bit about this project.
So back in May of 94, I was working at a newspaper called the Daily South Town, and I was assigned to go to 4 different places in a suburban Chicago that raised animals. There was a gentleman who raised wolves for educational purposes. I went to a horse farm. I went to a llama farm. And then the last place I went was this ramshackle tiny farm. It was a senior citizen couple and they were raising Angus beef cattle. And their name were Gene and Harlow Cagwin. And I showed up. It was basically a 2-hour assignment. I photographed them kind of herding their cattle and feeding the cattle. And so it was just basically just a day in the life of 2 cattle farmers. And as I was leaving, being a city boy, I really enjoyed that 2 hours. So I kind of offhand said, hey, can I come back by sometime and visit? And they were like, sure, that's great. And so a couple weeks later, I stopped by again and took a couple photographs, but mostly it was a social visit. And then it just kind of turned into a kind of a friendship for a short period where I would come over and Harlow and Gene would stop working, would sit in their kitchen and just kind of chat. And they didn't have any children, so I think I kind of became their surrogate, you know, grandchild. And so we kind of hung out and talked. And the Daily South Town was not a great photo newspaper. We weren't encouraged to do long-term photo stories. It was very daily-driven. So I really just kind of – this became a personal project, even though I wasn't photographing much to start out with. Then I got a job at a place called the Herald News in Joliet, which was also nearby the farm. And they really wanted you to do – photo projects and you had to come up with ideas. So kind of without any other ideas, I said, well, I know this senior citizen cattle farm, you know, that sounds interesting. They're like, yeah, sure, go do that. And so I had to show up and pretty much tell Gene and Harlow, okay, I'm going to actually start photographing like I always said I was. So I was just wondering if when I show up next time that if we could, like, you can just keep working. You don't have to stop and talk to me. And they're like, oh, okay. And so pretty much then I just started creating images for the newspaper. And it did start out to continue to be just a daily life of senior citizen cattle farmers. And then Harlow started having health issues. He had arthritis and carpal tunnel syndrome, and Gene had a bout with cancer. So it became a story of more about aging. And then a lot of the farms in the area started being sold to subdivision developers. So suburban sprawl became this issue. And so, you know, we all kind of saw that coming. And Gene and Harlow knew that at some point, you know, at that time, when I met Harlow in 94, he was 71. Gene was 61. And so they knew they weren't going to farm forever. And so I kind of knew that a subdivision developer would someday show up to buy their property. And this was in the, you know, the housing boom in the suburbs of Chicago. One of the township they lived in was one of the kind of fastest growing areas of Chicago. And so I kind of in my head said, okay, well, I'm going to stay with this story until they leave the farm. And that's going to be the story. And so on July 2nd, 2002, after they had sold their farm to a subdivision developer, I sat there and photographed Harlow Cagwin sitting on a felled tree in his front yard as his house he'd lived in his last 75 years was knocked to the ground.
Mm-hmm. That's a very powerful image.
Yeah, it's probably the best photo I've ever made in my career. Just, you know, it just kind of 8 years of access all kind of built up into that one moment.
Yeah.
And so Harlow and Jean watched the house get knocked down, and then they drove away, and they bought another farm about 2 hours south just to live on. They weren't going to farm anymore, but they wanted to live on a farm. And so that was an 8-year project, and I thought that that was the end of it. And it, you know, one of the stories that I made out of that was part of my National Newspaper Photographer of the Year portfolio. You know, I'd won many awards. You know, I showed their work at the Smithsonian, at National Geographic. You know, it was published a lot of places, mm-hmm. so it was great. Mm-hmm. And it was also something I owned. It was like one of the few projects, even though I was shooting it for the newspaper, I made a deal with the newspapers I was working at that I'd been working on this project and I want to retain the copyright.
Yeah.
And that was something that was crucial later, although I never really, I'm really not sure why I did that. I must have seen a photo talk or something. So that was 2002. And, you know, a couple years went by. I would visit Jean and Harlow at their new farm, but I wasn't really interested in documenting their lives anymore. I continued to be friends with them, but I didn't really see much great photographs in them sitting around their new house, you know? And so I just kind of just, they became my friends again. But then it just started nagging at me. The land sounded like very, you know, the land kind of called me, like that's something I wanted to document. And the way that the Caguin farm sale went is they stayed on the farm for about a year as they started building the subdivision around them. So it wasn't like they left and then all of a sudden they started building the subdivision. They were really kind of working on it as while they were still living there. So I had photographed a little bit of the subdivision being built and some of the model homes. So I kind of started thinking, well, maybe I want to do a story on the subdivision, and maybe I could find one family in the subdivision, and someday I could have a book that the first half would be the farm, the second half would be the subdivision, and maybe a subdivision family would have like cow salt and pepper shakers to tie it all together. Just something to tie it together.
Connection.
Yeah. I was looking for a connection. So 2003 became 2004, became 2005, became 2006. I visited a couple times, met a couple families. They just didn't seem right. And I kind of was thinking that maybe the second half of the story would never happen. Then in 2007, I was giving a talk to a college, small college outside Chicago, kind of an adult photo class. And I showed my farm story. And at the end of it, a woman raised her hand and said, hi, I live in that subdivision. And I was like, oh, really? And she's like, yeah. And I'm like, you know, I said, well, can I come visit you? And she said, sure. And I showed up and it was perfect. They lived on the end of a cul-de-sac called Cinnamon Court. They had four kids. Three of them were triplets. They had two dogs. One of the dogs looked like a cow. You know, so it was just this perfect thing. And so I showed up on a day when the entire subdivision, the entire cul-de-sac was doing an Easter egg hunt. And so I introduced myself to everyone in the cul-de-sac, said, hi, my name's Scott. I'm from the Tribune. I did a photo story on the farmers who lived here, and I want to do one on the subdivision. And is that okay? And they all gave permission. So I was able, a creepy middle-aged man, to just kind of show up at any time and photograph their kids, right?
Yeah.
And so, but then I quickly realized that the Grabenhofer family, which was Amanda, the woman I met in the photo class, that I had the greatest access with them, and they were the most interesting. I still didn't know what I was going to do with these photographs. I mm-hmm. still thought maybe it'll be a book at some point. But my second visit, I was photographing Ben, their oldest son, playing with his cousin CJ in the front yard, and they were wrestling around with his jump rope. And it reminded me of a photo I'd taken on the farm of Harlow, the farmer, kind of wrestling with a calf that got loose with a regular rope. And so I went home that night, and I put the two photos together as diptychs, where I had the farmer photo on the left and the subdivision on the right. And I kind of felt that that was the best way for me to document the passing of time on one piece of land, is to compare and contrast life then and life now on the same piece of land. And so I immediately was able to put together four or five pairings. And then I did a couple aerials that I had, like an old one and a new one. And then it was just so easy from there on. I would go to the subdivision, I would be photographing, and I would see something that reminded me of the farm. Or I would make a photo on the subdivision that I really liked, and I'd go back through my pile and piles of negatives and find images that kind of matched. And so over time, I was able to assemble, you know, a couple hundred of these pairings, which I think maybe about 75 are really good. And so I stepped on the subdivision for the first time to photograph the subdivision family in March of 2007, and in February of 2008, I had 4 pages in National Geographic of it. You know, so it was wow. great. It like really kind of took off.
Yeah. Working toward that Wimbledon.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so, and then it kind of just snowballed. I kept shooting it, and then it became Media Storm did a video on it, which you can see on my book site, which it then became a book. And so that's a commongroundthebook.com. So if you go there, you can buy the book, you can see the video that Media Storm did. And so it was definitely one of those things where I had no idea what it was going to be. And it just kind of kept snowballing. And then it became this amazing project where now whenever I go back to Chicago, I'll stop by the subdivision, hang out, make 4 or 5 more photos, and make 4 or 5 more pairings and stuff. And, you know, and life is evolving. The Grabenhoffers are getting divorced, you know, and so that's like a thing where I don't know what that means. They might move out of the home. They might, you know, Ed, the father might go and the family might stay. I don't know. So yeah. That's like, you know, just kind of an interesting kind of thing where I don't know exactly where that's going to go. I remember at one point, maybe 3-4 years ago, Ed got laid off from his job and I had this evil thought in my head, ooh, maybe they have to move out of their house, you know? And it was like, it was creepy, but it was like photographically.
But
I was
you're
just
thinking
like,
about
yeah,
the
like,
story.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, you know, so I don't know what's going to happen now. It's something where I think at this point, you know, the story is 97% complete, but it'll be interesting. I'm never going to stop working at it.
Right,
I'll probably photograph all the kids' marriages and things like that, but it'll be interesting. But it's definitely, it's kind of like, I think the idea of, you know, kind of pairing photographs was kind of what made it special. And it just kind of happened organically, just like everything else. It seems like in my career, it just kind of happens. I don't really put too much forethought to it. But you know, if you took any two photographs and put them together, they make each other better, no matter what they are.
Right.
But when you can kind of, you know, make these comparisons, it's kind of fun to just kind of look back and forth. And the farm photos are timeless. Excuse me. The farm photos are timeless, but the suburban photos are already dated.
Mm-hmm.
I have photos from 2007, 2008 of these big bulky televisions, you know, and different phone technology. So that's the interesting thing where it almost probably will get to a point, some point I could do a subdivision story just on the changes just in the subdivision, because life and technology is moving so much quicker than anything ever happened during the farm years.
Mm-hmm. A ton of different elements, but you're watching two separate lives evolve simultaneously.
Right.
That's the diptychs that you're talking
about. And also makes you realize that, you know, no matter where you live, where you grew up, people are people, you know? And it's like, we all kind of have the same habits and we all kind of do the same things. And when I was in the middle of this project, I remember going to the grocery store and I would see stuff that would match, you know, something Harlow would do. And like everywhere I would see comparisons. And so it really, I got the idea, it was simple. It's just like, you know, getting the idea is always kind of the tricky part.
Yeah.
You know? Cause you always see these other photo projects. You're like, oh, why didn't I think of that? That's so simple, you know, but it's just kind of having anything come together and work out is always fun.
You know, what made it interesting for me is that although you shot this in Illinois and the suburbs of Chicago, it's almost a microcosm of what's going on all over the
small
country.
Town America.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people in a lot of different regions can relate to this.
Well, yeah, I can relate it to San Francisco on a greater scale, just watching everything change and people move and push out.
Right. Yeah. I have so many people come up to me like, oh, my grandparents live on a farm, or I used to drive by this farm. And it's like, you know, there's a great, you know, people have like, they definitely, you know, apply their own life experiences onto my photographs. And that's the key.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what going back to talking about emotion in street photography is, if you can connect with someone, if you connect emotion that someone's felt with someone else's emotion, you know, that's where you kind of create that bond with photography.
Right,
and I think that's the whole magic of it. It's just, you know, like, you know, whenever I see photographers go to other countries and they just kind of make these snapshots of small kids looking up at the camera, for me, it's just like, it works on a certain level, but I just feel like there could be so much more, you know, it's just,
work a little harder and get the story more.
Right. Yeah. And I think my whole approach through photography has been to photograph my backyard instead of going across the globe, where I feel like I can find amazing, great moments in my community, you know, in San Francisco, in Chicago, you know, in the suburbs, wherever that, where I don't have to go to Afghanistan, or I don't have to go to the beaches of Greece and shoot refugees, which is still amazing work that needs to be done. I'm not saying it's not valid. It's incredibly valid. But for my own photography, you know, I prefer just to shoot the everyday and make something interesting out of the everyday instead of going someplace where everything is already interesting, you know, because I think that makes me lazy too. Yeah. Like I don't investigate enough. When I go someplace that's incredibly visual, I don't work hard at all. I'm like, I just kind of, oh, snap, snap, great, I'm done, you know, where when you see something every day over and over and over again, to find something unique in that everyday experience, I think is the fun part. And I love doing that. You know, just kind of finding a universal truth in an everyday moment is my goal, I think, definitely. Yeah.
It's a perfect representation of Americana. Like, you know, something that every person here in this country can relate to in some form or fashion, be that the aging part you're talking about, the changing of your town. I mean, even in a 5-year span, a lot changes in a place. In your particular situation, that was 8 years initially, and then 22 now. It's just different worlds. It's amazing.
I should do this now. I keep saying I should have done this before. But even if you just walk down in your neighborhood and you took a snapshot of the front of every building or every store and just made prints of them and put them away for 40 years and then brought it back out, and you could have a book and people would be like, that's amazing. Look at that. Oh, I remember, you know, it's like,
yeah,
but you know, we forget to do that. You know, just like I think that was the power of Vivian Meyer's work in Chicago, where, you know, all of a sudden this work came out of nowhere, you know, from 40, 50, 30 years ago, and people were just blown away because it was just, it had so much, you know, there was so much, it was the perfect storm of things, you know, it was great work, but also it was hidden and it was just a, you know, nostalgia to it. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, I think, you know, kind of that whole thing, you should have kept that digital card, you know, hidden for 20 more years.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I should have just threw it away.
Although you wouldn't be able to access it. So.
True.
But that's another thing, like I was thinking before, where I think my work now has this kind of throwawayness to it in my street photography, mm-hmm. where it's just kind of in the moment and then gone. And the way technology is, you know, who knows? Like the work we're creating now, if we're not shooting on film, I don't shoot film at all, but I feel like my digital work, it's very possible in 50 years, no one will be able to see any of it.
Yeah,
that's
true.
You know? Yeah, because, floppy disk.
Yeah, yeah, I have stuff on jazz drives. And, yep. You know, it's just like.
Big blue zip disk.
Yep, yep. Yeah, it's like gone. Like I really have like this whole gap in my photo career from when I first started shooting digital till maybe 6-7 years in, where I don't have any of those photos because they weren't backed up anywhere. They weren't on hard drives.
Very vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Like, yeah, you can't find anything of mine from, you know, the mid-90s to maybe the mid-2000s because it just doesn't exist anywhere.
I had the same thing in the early 2000s myself where I lost 3-4 years worth of work. And it was a time when I was pretty prolific, like shooting.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And not really with the intent that I do today, but it was still well enough. It's friends, family, all that.
Right, yeah.
And sure enough, it's computer related. You know, it would be vulnerable or it's not immune to loss.
Right.
And I remember sitting there watching my computer shut down and begin smoking out the back of it. And I knew in that moment, I'm watching this isn't backed up. None of this is backed up. So it lost it all. And that is heart wrenching.
Yeah.
Do you have something there, Jim?
Yeah. Now that I freaked everyone out that all their photographs will never be seen again.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying.
Yeah.
Get everything printed, everybody.
Yeah. Make prints. Exactly.
Plus, you won't know how nice an image is until you see it on a print.
Yeah.
I just firmly believe that. I did have a question. You had made a comment when you were talking about Common Ground a while ago about the ownership of work, particularly being a photojournalist working for a paper. I'm sure that probably becomes a bit murky water sometime when knowing what is yours and what isn't.
Yeah. Well, like now it's like I will go out while I'm being paid by the San Francisco Chronicle when I have nothing to do. And I will go out and I'll do street photography with my iPhone between assignments. And I will post them to my personal Instagram account. Sometimes I'll post them to the San Francisco Chronicle's branded Instagram account.
Oh, you had the hip thing.
Right.
You know, little stuff you're doing
inside. I used to have a blog at the Tribune. I had a blog at the Chronicle. And yeah, it's like, who knows who owns what?
You know? And
when I was at the Chicago Tribune, the bosses were a little draconian. They were like, everything you photograph at all times with any camera on your personal time on vacation is ours.
What?
And we're all like, okay, sure. Great idea.
Yeah.
You know, like I don't think they could ever, you know, make that stand up, but that's what they thought. They thought that, you know, anything we created, they owned, you know, and that's a little much. You know, the Chronicle is much more creatively advanced than that. And, you know, they're really great But still, it's murky. It's like, who knows? You know, mm-hmm. if I make this amazing photograph, my iPhone, while I'm out there, some super newsworthy image, you know.
Whose is it going to be?
Yeah, who owns it? You know, and you know, what if it happens 2 minutes before my shift starts, but then it goes into 2 minutes into the, you know, it's just like.
Right, yeah.
Or during your lunch break. Right, or, right. I mean, at a time when you just have no clue. And then timestamps and.
Right, yeah. So it's, but that's my deal with the devil, though, working for a newspaper where I know, mm-hmm. you know.
But you get health insurance.
I get health insurance. I get a company car.
Yeah.
I get a salary.
There's a trade-off there.
So I, you know, I have to give up the copyright. And 99.9% of the time, it doesn't.
Be a problem.
You know, and I did this Instagram print sale, and you know, a lot of those photos were taken while I was working at the Tribune, a couple probably while I was working for the Chronicle, some while I was off work. You know, it wasn't like it was big money, so it wasn't worth it for them to do anything about it. And I don't think anyone even cared or thought about it. But but when it came down to it, I assume I was probably selling some work that I did not own the copyright to.
Mm-hmm.
So it's. But yeah, it's when you work as a staff job, it does get a little murky at times of who owns what. And Common Ground was something where I went out of my way, you know, to get in writing ahead of time before I started working anything that I would always own this. And even with that, when it ran in National Geographic, my boss at the time still was like, "You can't do that. We own that." And I'm like, "No, you don't." You know, like your predecessor made this agreement with me, and he was like, "Oh, okay." You know, and so if I wouldn't have had it in writing, he was going to fight me over it. But that's like the only thing I have in my career that I have in writing that I own the mm-hmm. copyright to.
Now, you did when you were at the Tribune, you did a blog, From the Hip.
Yeah, Shooting from the Hip.
For Shooting from the Hip. And that was started out as a personal blog, but it got absorbed by the Tribune.
Yeah, so that was I started doing a personal blog, and then I was putting Tribune photos on my personal blog. And then they were like, "No, you can't do that. You can, you know," and so that got murky. Then like, "Well, how about this? Why don't we just have the blog on our site?" But then, of course, because I was putting personal work on my Tribune blog, I guess they then got the copyright of it just for, you know, so it was really.
God, that's complicated.
Yeah. And so when I came to the Chronicle, I started doing a blog called SF the Hip. So Shooting from the Hip, but SF San Francisco. So that was my creative idea too. But then I kind of got burned out with blogging. I started feeling I was just repurposing social media content. You know, I was like shooting street photography and I was putting it on Instagram, and then I would do a blog post of my street photography that always was on Instagram. I just kind of felt it was like a little much, and you know, I almost felt like, you know, I would go to a party and I would start telling a story and someone would be like, "Oh yeah, I read that on your blog." You know, it's just like, it was like everything was on my blog. So like I didn't have to talk to anyone anymore. And so that kind of got to be a drag too. So I do like writing, and I kind of feel that there's like a little void in my life right now where I don't really have a outlet for writing. So I kind of would like to resurrect something. I don't know if the blog's the right thing, but I'll have to figure that out. But I do enjoy writing.
Yeah, it's like me. I enjoy writing too. I'm trying to start a blog, but for some reason, I always want to go back out and shoot.
Right.
You know, and I never have time to write, you know,
yeah.
That's the thing.
Wow. I was kind of a writer before a lot of this. So it kind of helped. That was in journalism class when I was in college and things like that. So being an editor of the paper, you kind of learn to work your words. And that's what I did before I learned to work my camera.
Right.
And so it's definitely benefited me in recent time, but it's the hardest thing is trying to keep up with it.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of parallels. You know, if you're putting together a photo story, you don't want any redundancies. And when you're writing, you don't want to use redundancy of the same word or something like that. So there's a lot of parallels to it.
I think that's one of the big issues I'm coming into now is I have a project in mind. I have something I want to do, but I also want to share those images. So every time I go to share them, I think to myself, well, if I share this now, then it's going to take away something from the end piece.
Right.
And so I don't want to share it. And then the project takes longer and then I never share it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. And it seems like that's like the model now to get your name out there. Where when I started out, you know, you started a small paper, you'd move up, you'd enter the clip contest. I don't know if you guys even know what a clip contest is. And then, you know, you would maybe hopefully win an award in a year-end contest, and that would how you get your name out there. And now it seems like you kind of go, you work on a project, and you just like drop it on Lensblog or on, you know, one of the other kind of big media, you know, photo sites. And, you know, it almost seems like the way the photographers do it now is where, like, instead of trying to be the jack of all trades, it's best just go away, do a story, you know, spend a year, then come back. and then just show the world this great story. And that's how you get your name out there. It's totally different models when I started out in photography in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s. Mm-hmm.
Disappear for a while. What was that, Apocalypse Now?
Yeah.
He walks up, he's got all the cameras.
Yeah, no film.
Yeah, no film. He's just taking pictures of nothing. Marlon Brando holding him around by a leash.
Yeah. Yeah. Good old Dennis Hopper. Yeah.
That's who I was looking for. Dennis Hopper. Yeah.
And yeah, those sounds like my anxiety dreams where like I'm always photographing a tornado without any film in my camera, or I don't have a lens, or the lens won't go on, or my camera's in my car. Or, you know, so it's like, oh.
In an asylum with a paintbrush, painting on a wall with no paint.
Exactly. No wall.
Do you have any projects that you're working on now or coming up you want to talk about?
No, I've been so distracted by sports here.
I noticed that with
your... Because I'm a sports photographer too. You know, like sometimes I feel like I have too many irons in the fire.
Let's move into that. Yeah, because you got some amazing imagery of the Warriors I've seen.
So basically I got the Chronicle and I just jumped right on the Giants, you know, bandwagon and photographed them through the World Series. And then the Warriors were, you know, on their amazing run, and it keeps getting more and more amazing. And then the Super Bowl and... You know, so it's just,
it's a good time to be in San Francisco for a sports photographer.
Yeah. And I love sports photography and I hate sports photography at the same time. You know, it's like, for me, it's like empty calories. It's it's like dessert where it's great for a day or it's great for a moment, but then it's gone, you know? So I try to still make images that are lasting, and that kind of outlive the shelf life of just one game, but it's difficult in sports.
There was one shot that I think I remember on, it was on your Instagram account, where you had, it was a black and white shot of the players coming out. They were in the tunnel and they were coming out, and I love that
the
shot.
49ers.
The 49ers. Yeah. Oh, thanks. I love that shot. Thanks. That was a great shot.
Yeah. So like I kind of alluded to the sports, iPhone show I'm going to have in Toronto. And it's almost like all before game stuff, you know, because I don't shoot anything, of course, during the game. I can't take that chance. So it's like all beforehand. So I do a lot of iPhone stuff at sporting events before and a little bit after, but most of the time I'm editing then. But yeah, I do love sports and it's fun. And I'm super excited to shoot the Super Bowl. I shot 3 Olympic games and those were amazing. And you know, I photographed Michael Jordan in the NBA finals. So I think I'm probably one of the few photographers that have followed the 72 win Bulls team and now are following hopefully the 73 win Warriors team, because I've thrown all that Bulls stuff away.
Yeah.
Like seriously, because I'm invested in the Warriors now and I never thought I'd be that, because I was always like in the Heat years when they were like, you know, doing really well. Like, no, I don't want that Bulls record to be broken.
Yeah.
But I've decided that I like me better, you know, so I want to cover the Warriors. I want to be there for history.
Well, it's time for some more diptychs.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. There you go.
Yeah.
Except I think all those, I have very little Jordan photos. I have some negatives.
Yeah.
You know, which I have to go back through and look through.
That's okay. There was still Rodman and Pippen and Kukoc and, you know.
Yeah. So, but yeah, no, I think sometimes, like right now, I'm not working on any long-term stories just because I'm shooting so much sports.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's fine. Although I wish that I could clone myself. But the thing about living in the Bay Area, which I didn't have in Chicago, is that I'm really enjoying life outside photography here.
Yeah.
You know, I moved up to Marin and so I'm hanging out, I'm going to Stinson Beach and, you know, going hiking.
God,
and
that's
stuff.
A gorgeous area.
It's beautiful. And it's like, I'm kind of like, oh, wait.
I was going to ask about the transition from Chicago to San Francisco.
No, it's like
Bay
I have a greater life work balance here than I did in Chicago. Because Chicago, I love Chicago. It'd always be home. And I remember always hearing people saying, oh, San Francisco is a more beautiful city than Chicago. And I was like,
nah,
I don't think so. And then I get here and I'm like, oh, yeah,
it is. Oops.
Yeah. And so but Chicago, yeah, it was just work, you know, and I would work on my off time and I would, you know, go over to the subdivision on my off time, or I'd do street photography on my off time. And occasionally I would say hi to my kids.
Yeah.
But,
on the way out.
Yeah, exactly. But here, like I'm enjoying life so much that it's definitely interesting, and it's, you know.
The gear is definitely different, I've noticed. You don't feel like you're in, you know, high gear running 90 mile an hour all the time. I mean, you are, because you're working and you're constantly working on trying to get to the office and get to your gig. But in Chicago, I always felt like as soon as I walked out that door, go, you know, and get away from the cold. It's too cold.
Oh,
one door to the next door.
Well, I think that's why I'm here mostly, is that my last winter in Chicago.
What year was it?
That was 2014, I think. So 2000... that was, it was like 23 below one day. And, and of course, as a photographer, your job is to go out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Photograph. And the only other people out there are other photographers.
Yep. Yep. It's just like the snow of 2011 is what got me this snow, Snowmageddon or right, whatever, where they had the red eye with the picture of Kennedy. Yeah. That was when me and my wife looked at each other and said, it's time to leave.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it, but.
Yeah. So no, I'm happy here. Yeah. Definitely. I'm
not wait a minute. So how long you've only been
I've here only been here since July of 2014.
Is that right? Okay.
Really?
Yep. Okay. All right.
Yeah. Seems like you've been, I mean, just the way that you talk about it and talk about the area, it seems like you've been here longer.
Yeah. Well, I think that's as a newspaper photographer, that's like the greatest way to get to know a place because
you're get
out
ingrained.
There all the time.
Yeah.
You know, I think my first month here, there was the Napa earthquake. And so the first time I was ever in Napa was in the complete darkness at 4 a.m.
Wow.
You know, with all glass all over the place. I had no idea where I was going. Luckily, I had a couple editors that were up where they were like kind of leading me from like the trailer park fire to downtown to a winery that, you know, so, but yeah, it was just the first time I was in Napa was after the earthquake. It was just amazing.
Did you follow any of the wildfires that was going on?
I just got up for the aftermath of the Valley Fire this year. I was in Chicago when that was kind of blown up, and I went up for like one day to Calistoga to like the place where the people were staying. Then I went up to Cobb and Middletown and so it was just mostly all burnt out stuff. But, you know, I'm a little freaked out about that. I have no, that's like where I'm totally over my head.
Yeah, you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I have all the fire gear, but I have no idea what I'm doing. And what's amazing about California is, you know, media, go wherever you want.
Right.
You know, or Chicago, you couldn't do anything. You can go anywhere here. You know, yeah, just go.
Get in your car, start driving.
Yeah.
Like, Why are you here? Call me from the road.
But like, there's so many amazing photographers in the Bay Area, it just blows me away. And so like Kent Porter, like, I don't know if you know him, he did some great work with the fire. And, you know, and there's so many great freelancers too, you know, Justin Sullivan from Getty, Noah Berger, you know, all these guys just really news hounds. And
yeah,
so if I ever really have to shoot a real fire, I'll just latch onto one of them, you know, and just kind of
jump on their back and ride on
follow them around. Yeah. So, but no, it just seems like I didn't really get shoot much of the fire stuff, which I wasn't disappointed.
No complaints. Yeah. I saw some of the video of like there was a guy on a bike that rode through there with the fire on the left and right sides. It looked like something from a horror movie. It was terrifying looking.
Yeah, apocalyptic scene. Something like that.
The towards the end of War of the Worlds.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But what would you say, like, as far as the projects you've had an opportunity to do out here, is there any that stick out to you? Any of them that you remember vividly?
I did a story on some bus drivers down in San Jose who worked for PayPal and Apple who were living in their cars, you know, where, you know, it was kind of this unique situation where they'd be driving these multimillionaires to work, or not multimillionaires, but tech workers who were
making a couple of guys.
But then they would go home and they would live in their car. And so that was kind of fascinating. So that was one of the more interesting stories. It seems like a lot of the stories here are very housing based, you know, people who are getting evicted or, you know, being sent out. So that was good. And I just like doing little essays. I did this kind of paparazzi flash thing on WrestleMania fans. And I just kind of like finding ironic, quirky things in everyday life that interests me. But yeah, I'm hoping to find some long-term story, but it just seems like nothing really has found me because I'm not someone who like researches stuff. It always finds me. And it just seems like, you know, just in my year and a half here so far, nothing's really found me, but I'm not too worried about it. I hope the paper's not too pissed off at me, but it's,
Well, sometimes the project finds you, like Common Ground. You didn't know after eight years it was going to continue.
Yeah. So, you know, and that's how I've always done it. And it's always kind of worked that way. Or usually most of my stories come from daily assignments. And that, you know, Common Ground came from a daily assignment that I just kind of, you know, took it a step farther. And so that's definitely, you know, I guess if I had to, there's probably three or four stories that are kind of in the back of my head I'd like to work on. But right now I'm just, you know, it is sports.
This might be an interesting segue because when we were researching this discussion that we were going to have with you, one of the things I found really interesting was your take on finding inspiration.
Do you mean just like looking at other people's work? Or?
No, there's some of the things you mentioned are creating a motivation generation routine.
Yeah, you know, I don't even like sometimes I'll write something and I totally forget I wrote it, but mm-hmm. so like I'm not exactly sure of what you're talking about, but yeah, I'm like I do try to find inspiration in a lot of things, and most of it is other people's work, and you know, just kind of looking. You know, I'm on Instagram and Facebook, and whenever there's a big news event, I remember like 9/11. I just sat for days and days and days and could not see enough photographs from that. Mm-hmm. I just would like be searching and searching and searching and searching for more and more work. And you know, I have just an incredible visual appetite where I just it's never filled. And if I wasn't shooting the Super Bowl this year. Well, even shooting the Super Bowl this year, like I will be looking at everyone else's work too at the same time. But yeah, it's
which is kind of hard because you find yourself like if you're self-critical, like I am, if I'm looking at other people's work while doing my own, I start second guessing, and I always got to be careful not to allow my style to evolve away from my general path.
It definitely is. It is kind of risky sometimes to. See someone else doing successful work and then trying to copy them. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's the thing that you really have to do is that, you know, embrace the uniqueness in your vision, you know, that, and I think that's the hardest thing to do, especially when you're a young photographer, because especially if you have like an older photographer give you a portfolio review and they say you're bad or something. And that just, you know, I've met so many photographers that will say, oh yeah, you know, 3 years ago, this person said this, or 20 years ago, this person said this, uh-huh. you know, and it's like, so I'm like super careful to like not be an asshole basically when I'm, you know, not that that's my nature anyways. I'm always trying to build up photographers and try to find something to say, okay, this is what's good in your work, you know, work on this mm-hmm. instead of saying this is all bad, because that doesn't do anyone any good at all.
Especially in this day and age, you have a major proliferation of imagery online and it's just coming at you in waves. But it's kind of a weird contradiction because while it is coming at you in waves, no, you also can't get any footing. You know, when you go to send out your work or you go to share your work, it becomes difficult to get eyes on it because of that wave that's coming in.
Yeah, but I also feel that the more photography that is out there, the more that great photography rises above. It becomes even more obvious. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're seeing 100 mediocre photos, when you finally see that one great one, wow, that's really good as compared to if you see two photos and, you know, it just doesn't, you know. So I think there is still the ability to be successful in this business, but you either have to like work your ass off, have, you know, a great idea, be a great marketer. So there's different ways to do it. You know, like there's some like photographers who aren't super talented, but they're really successful because they are marketing their ass off.
Business geniuses.
Yep. And that's not me at all.
Yeah.
So I think there's still many ways to do it. And, you know, and they'll always, it's the world has never been more visual than it is now. It's everything is based on visuals now. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of video, you know, stills are super important. So there's a lot of, it's not the traditional way that I was raised. So being able to evolve and adapt and, you know, and not kind of get trapped in your old ways is really important.
Yeah. Speaking of that, you recently, you were a judge on a hip-tography
oh, right.
contest. Yeah. What was that?
Yeah. So that was, I think, the Mobile Photo Awards. Yeah. Daniel Berman. He's a Canadian photographer. He runs that. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, he just last year I judged also. And so, you know, he basically sent me 1,000 photographs and I got to like whittle it down to 30 or something.
Oh, yeah.
But I've judged a lot of photo contests and it's interesting where. You
that's
know.
A unique perspective. Yeah. To have.
And like
yeah.
the thing too is like photos go by like a half second at a time. It's like, nope, you know, it's just like, mm-hmm. and it's like kind of an unfair way to judge because some photographs take a little bit longer when you look at them a little bit longer, but it becomes like there are ways to where photographs will instantaneously for subconscious reasons. Well, that's a good photograph. That's not a good photograph. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, I don't know. I've never studied photography. So obviously I've heard of the rule of thirds and I kind of have an idea. And I've kind of heard of, you know, some people will say you have to create triangles in your photography. Yeah. I don't know what the hell that means. You know, but people are like, yeah. And, you know, the other people will say, you know, shoot verbs instead of nouns. You know, there's all these like
cliche your systematic things. Types.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, for me, it's like, if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. That's like, for me, that's it. You know,
yeah.
It's like,
you know what a good image looks like.
Yeah. It's like, you know, I think there was a Supreme Court justice who was like, you know, I can't define pornography, but I know it if I see it. It's like, and that's what great photography is. I can't define what great photography is, but I know it if I see it.
Yeah.
And it's just, there's no, you know, when you start thinking about it too much, that's when you're dead. You know, you can't overthink it. You know, I've seen some people just stand there and never push the button because they're, you could just see them thinking. You know, and it's like, you got to feel
moment's gone.
Yeah, I know, trying to compose, making sure they have the right settings. And
it's like if you see me trying to golf, you know, I'm like, okay, what am I supposed to do? What elbow am I supposed to bend? Wait, what? Yeah, you know, it's like plonk.
Slice.
Yeah.
Now, I heard somebody recently make an interesting comment about it was time spent on looking at an image. And when they first said it, I was like, that doesn't sound right. But they said, if somebody looks at your image for 4 seconds, then you're doing good. And when I first heard that, I was like, it seems not like a lot of time. But if you actually sit and think about when you're looking at images online, Instagram is a perfect example, 4 seconds is a long time.
Yeah.
And if you can garner, and that's what I thought about that when you were talking about going through the 1,000 images and one image after another. But if you stop on one, you find yourself, you know, you can click, 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 and all of a sudden, 1,000, 2,000, and so forth.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You're really feeding something out of it. And I just thought that was an interesting way of putting it. If you can get somebody's eyes on your work for 4 seconds, you know, enough substance in there, then you have a good piece, or at least a good jumping point.
Yeah, I used to study my photographs a ton. And like, I think it's important too to look at your work and just say, okay, where's my eye going? You know, like, what's the first thing I look at? Then where is my eye go next? And where's it go next? And where's it go next? You know, I feel like the most successful photographs will start out where you want them to see, and then it'll move to something, and then something, and back to where, you know, and it'll be this kind of, you know, really kind of smooth movement around a photograph. And so I think there's a way to construct photographs that will allow the viewer to be led where you want them to go.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have to, like, I'm doing that. I can do that with the camera at my hip. So, like, I'm not really thinking those things, you know. So, like, every single one of my Instagram photos, I did not look through. I just pushed the button from my hip, you know, and they look like, wow, that's really a great composition, you know, but it's all random, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I kind of have
an idea, and I know I can also, like, I turn it just this much and that much. So it's like, you have to do it over and over and over and over and over and over again until it becomes, you know, muscle memory or whatever, visual memory. And, you know, and you be able to lead the viewer around your photograph and make all those decisions, those hundreds of decisions, without thinking about them and instantaneously. And it sounds impossible, right? You know, like, it sounds impossible just even thinking about it right now. But it, you know, like, you have to get to that point if you're going to be consistently good.
Yeah,
but that's where the practice makes perfect.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can't just, you know, pick up a camera and go this weekend and then 3 months from now do it again. You're not going to pick it up.
Right. Yeah.
Embarrassingly enough, this happens to me a lot, where I would take a picture, you know, and you just instinctively know that this is a good shot. And even when you edit it and you put it up, you say, okay, you know, you see with it, but then the people will comment. And they'll say, oh, I see what you saw. Then they would come and they would show, they have these great insights into the photograph. You say, oh yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, I was trying for that.
Yeah, that's what I was trying for. And I look, I said, God, they're right. I didn't realize that until you mentioned it.
Yeah, I made this photo once of this. It was like a beauty pageant contestants were touring a bean canning factory, and they had like these, you know, hair nets on and stuff like that, and blue helmets. And someone said, oh, I love how that's like shows the homogenization of beauty and all the stuff. And what were you thinking when you took that? And like, I hope it's in focus.
Exactly.
You know, yeah, like there was like nothing, you know, like seriously, if you could see the inside of my brain, like when I'm with the big camera, it's just like, you have all those technical thoughts in your head. And I think that's another important thing too, is like, learn your camera so well that you don't have to think about it, where you can change the settings without thinking about it. And, you know, if you're adding all the technical things on top of the creative things, and that's, you know, that's even worse. I think that's a lot of young photographers' issues. Their photos aren't that good because they're still learning the technical aspects, you know, and if you're switching, like, I know I'm not a tech gear person at all. And I know there's a lot of photographers who feel if they get the next great camera, then they'll be a good photographer.
Right.
You know, but then they're constantly relearning new cameras. And where, like, every time the newspaper says, you know, and this is a great thing too, to recommend a newspaper, like, oh, here's a new camera, you know, and I'm not complaining that they give me a new camera every once in a while. But I sometimes am reluctant because, like, no, I know this camera so well. I don't, you know, like, I was happy with the Nikon D2H, you know, and it's just like, I don't want to change to a new camera because I know everything on this one. And I know what I want to do, and I don't want to have to relearn a new camera. And so it, you know, I think that's something that, you know, is important. And then, you know, that's what's good about film too. It's like film, you know, you can use the same camera for 50 years. You know,
yep. Yep. I think that's the reason why I switched, just because I knew I was in a position where I needed a new camera. I was looking at the X100T. I was thinking about switching to Fujifilm. It's a great system. I even handled the X Pro 2 the other day over at Looking Glass, and that's a fine camera. But I've always been wanting a Leica. It's just that kind of holy grail for a lot of people. And I had an opportunity to get it and jump full steam in, started developing, which, you learn very quickly how difficult a lot of that is, and especially shooting, because I'm the same way. I'm a hip shooter, and I've been shooting with EM5 for a while with that articulated screen, and that makes a huge difference when you're in the street. You develop that motor memory, know your camera.
Right.
And when I switched over to film, because I'd shot my Minolta for a long time, I kind of got a feel for that, but switching over to a rangefinder is, it takes patience to really get yourself familiar and shooting right. And hip shooting is just out of the gate, it's going to be a luck game. And I got one thereabouts out of my last roll. I thought it was decent. But it's going to definitely take more time, just day after day after day, getting used to it.
Right.
But I know that the camera is going to last me 5, 10, 20 years. If I ever have kids or my nieces or nephews, I know that's a camera I'll give to them. My EM5 might last next year.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm still shooting with my big hulking Nikon, shooting that from the hip. But the change I made was I used a new lens. Now I'm working with a 35mm lens. And when I first started out with that shooting from the hip, I was messing up everything,
right,
you know,
right.
Not getting nothing in focus, getting, you know, missing the, you know, the subject was half in the frame and half. And so but it took a lot of practice.
Were you using a zoom before?
Yeah, I was using a 28-75.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah. So I said, no,
I used to use a 24-70 zoom with a Canon 1DX doing street photography or whatever.
So I switched to that 35mm prime. Great lens, but I just could not get it right at first. You know, just everything messed up. Now, you know, with the practice, now I can shoot from the hip and pretty much get it, you know, get what I want from that.
35 was hard to get used to after the 50 I was on for a while.
Yeah.
Just that width, and you got to get closer, you know, and I'm not really one to be within 2 or 3 feet of people. I'm that 5 foot space kind of guy. So I know how they feel. And when I switched to 35, I was like, oh, okay, I got to break this barrier.
Yeah.
I still have to break that barrier. I still have to get closer.
Oh, I'm still afraid of people a lot of days.
Well, It's still the same way. I don't care how long you shoot me. Mm-hmm. You know, I've seen some people that can get in somebody's face and take a shot, and that's just not me.
No. I commend that. You're a Bruce Gilden type, you know, where it's like right in the face, flash. No, I won't even use flash at home, let alone in the street.
But the fascinating thing about Bruce Gilden is, you know, he said that like a lot of people will like see him take the photograph and they'll turn around and look over their shoulder. Like, what is he photographing? Like they think he's doing something else. Yeah. They're so close that they think he's photographing someone over their shoulder. And it's really interesting.
Watching the videos, you can actually see them do. I've noticed that because he's so fast. It's just boom. And then you're right. They're looking over their shoulder, not at him, but. What, is it a building or is it something else?
Right. Yeah. Like, yeah, I could never do that controversial street photography stuff. I mean, once I got a little lippy with someone, they pushed me in Michigan Avenue, you know? So it's like, okay, maybe that's not my approach. That doesn't quite work.
This don't work for me.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of Gilden, do you have any inspirations from?
Well, so the interesting thing, when I was 13, like I was raised by the television. So there used to be this show on PBS where they would show a half an hour segment on different photographers. And I remember I just, because back then I had like four channels, right? So I didn't have many choices.
3, 6, 12, 23.
Yeah. So channel 11 in Chicago, I was watching PBS and like I saw a news photographer segment, and then it was a sports photographer. And then one day they had this crazy man running around New York City, just taking random photos of people in the park and stuff. And I was just like, that was really odd and strange. And I never really thought about it again. And it turned out being Gary Winogrand.
Yeah.
And yeah, he's like probably my favorite photographer. 1964 is my favorite book. But I, Matt Stewart, English photographer, like great sense of humor. I love his work. You know, Martin Parr, you know, he's great. I love the English. They have such a great sense of humor. So funny.
Kind of definitely translates into their work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, there's so many like just great photographers, you know, here. It's, you know, just, you know, almost too many names to mention, you know, but it's.
You wish you could go through the laundry list.
Just yeah. It's almost kind of daunting how many great photographers there are in San Francisco and the Bay Area. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that was the most impressive thing I noticed when I got here is just like, there's a lot in Chicago that don't get me wrong.
Yeah, we don't want to disparage our Chicago friends.
No,
right.
But San Francisco, I think it's the nature of the weather. I think that has a big to do with it because you can go out anytime, whenever. I mean, you can in Chicago too, but it's going to be less or more miserable at that time.
Yeah. And San Francisco is a lot like Philly or New York or other cities like that. It's so condensed. It's so jam packed. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not like Chicago. I want to go back to Chicago now. It's like, there's so much room.
Right.
It's like, it's almost hard to make a photograph because everyone's so spread out. Yeah. You know? Mm-hmm. But in San Francisco, it's just, you know, jam packed. You turn a corner and you're a different world. And it's just amazing. You know, I keep going back to Chinatown over and over again. I really rarely make a good photograph there for some reason.
But you always end up
there.
Because
there's so much going on. Yeah. You know, like, I almost like, it's really strange. You would think I'd make a good photograph there at some point. But it's, yeah, it's really, you know, San Francisco is amazing. And like, I rarely photograph anywhere else, you know, around here. I never come into Oakland and do it.
Yeah.
You know,
Oakland's, I've been doing a little bit more here recently.
Yeah. And it's like people, you know, I spent so much time on the west side and south side of Chicago. People are, oh, aren't you afraid of Oakland? I was like, no.
No.
Please.
Yeah.
Come on. It's like, it's so overblown. You know, it's like you can get, you know, if you're going to sit and worry about getting mugged, just stay home, you know, because it's just, you know, that's stupid.
It's a gated community person thinking about how dangerous it is to take out the garbage.
Yes, exactly.
One of the interesting things is just like you said, how Chicago is so spread out. The difference between shooting in Chicago and San Francisco, at least for me, is that a lot of life is lived in the streets of San Francisco, more so than in Chicago. I mean, like, again, at least it's so compact. The weather is a lot more agreeable than Chicago. So,
farmers markets.
Yeah, exactly.
In Chicago, it's a lot of garage to garage activity.
Yeah.
Your car and, you know, and people don't want to stick their head outside. But and the good thing is it's not 80 here all the time. I love the fact that it does get a little cold, of, you know, every once in a while.
Oh, yeah. I'm
every 10 years it rains, you know, that's like, it's very refreshing. So.
I do miss, I so miss the alleyways of Chicago though, the graffiti art and everything, the dumpsters like that. That is probably the one thing I miss most that I cannot find out here. Like, there's great alleys and stuff here, but I just always found it to be a bit grittier, a bit, more characterized, you know, but I don't know. That's stereotypical of Chicago. That's the thing there.
Right.
Every city is going to have, in my opinion, something that is going to isolate it from the others, really define that city for the work that I'm doing myself.
Right.
And the alleyways was always that for me with Chicago. What you said a while ago about the neighborhood shift, that you turn a corner, it's something completely different. That's what I find synonymous with San Francisco, is it is so starkly different from one block to the next. Mm-hmm. And I do find myself at Chinatown a lot. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I hate myself for it because I always end up there. It's not good or bad. It's just, I end up there and I've gotten some really great shots, but I always know I've been at this corner 100 times before. But you can always find something different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll walk through and I'm like, wow, man, I made so many great photos. And then I look at them like, no, I didn't.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
I was like, what happened?
It's like, what the hell happened here? where did it attempt it? I looked, it looked great. And then now it's like two faces or one. actually, I did have a quick question. Where, talking about places to shoot, where is your favorite place? You got any favorites in San Francisco? Like that you, I mean, I know you go to the market and everything when you're off hours.
Yeah. But. I like Sixth Street between Mission and Market. Oh, it's brilliant.
Yeah. I love it.
It's like, cause it's not like the other part of the Tenderloin where it's just people. It's just like there's so many vibrant people on that street. I just like that one block is just amazing. I don't know what it is.
You can spend hours.
Yeah, it's just fantastic. You know, like the pawn shops. Yeah. And there's a, like a barber shop. And yeah, like I'll walk down there. I need to like spend more time there. That's like my favorite block for sure.
I just recently got a shot there. This guy who was dressed, he looked like a pimp. You know, he had the fur collar. He had the hat. I think it probably had a feather in
it. Please tell me he had a cane.
Yeah. And he was walking and he flashed in front of me and I just got this shot of him. And there above him, and you know, when I looked at the shot above him, it was a billboard that said, "Take the wine train to Napa."
Nice.
You know,
it's like, nice. So, yeah.
You know, oh, that was right there on 6th Street, you know, and you're right. Yeah. You know, you get so many characters and stuff on.
When I got Mike Koepka, you know, Mike Koepka's work at all. He was at the Chronicle anyways. So he's in DC now. His wife got a job there. So he moved, but I would like photograph someone like that. And I put it on Instagram and he'd be like, "Oh yeah, that's Crazy Charlie. Yeah. I photographed him in 2002. Too." He would like always like, you know, piss on my work just to, you know, because oh no, that's you know, Marvelous Milda. Oh yeah, I photographed her a long time ago. It's just like you knew the name of everybody. Yeah. You know, I was just like, oh.
Well, I think we lost one here recently, the Bush scare guy.
Oh yeah, right.
Yeah, there's a dude down there.
Oh yeah, him, yeah.
He'd been doing that for 10, 15 years. Yeah, I think.
I never saw him.
I never saw him.
I had no idea what they were talking about.
I saw it come across. I was like, oh, that's unfortunate, but I've been down there a lot. I never got scared by this fellow.
Yeah, that's another good place too in the wharf there where they have all those like restaurants and seagulls. Mm-hmm. That's always an interesting place too.
Yeah, the seagulls because like they're so brazen.
Yeah,
like I love catching somebody getting attacked.
Yeah, and I like photographing tourists a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that'll be my summer project. I don't know. There's something about it. I think
the nature and the way
like,
that
I guess they all kind of, you know, they like in Chicago there was a ton of Eastern European tourists that would go up and down Michigan Avenue, and I always found them really fascinating. And so I think, you know, it's just, there's a certain brand of tourist that'll go to the wharf, you know?
Yeah.
Because
like,
there's no one from San Francisco down there, you know?
It's just right,
like,
right.
You know,
unless
so,
we're down there with a camera.
Right, exactly. Yeah, because whenever people like approach me down there, I'm like, I'm not a tourist. I live here. You know, it's just like, no. But it's, yeah, like, yeah, I don't know. I think the whole touristy thing is really fascinating to me.
You know, that was one of the things that I talked about in the last show, and I called it my dead zone. And it's one of those areas, one of those things, like a place where a lot of tourists, where I just find no inspiration whatsoever. I just can't shoot. So I said, you know what? I'm going to take a look at these tourists, you know, in this dead zone, tourism, and I'm going to try to find something in this. You know, there's got to be something in it. And, you know, I went to the wharf and I went to Union Square, which is another place that's a dead zone for me. And I did find, you know, I did come up with something interesting. You know, it was the tourist.
Yeah.
It's like, maybe there is something in this, you know? So that's going to be my goal for 2016 is to work these tourists a little bit and see what it is about these tourists.
Like, you know, when it comes down to subcultures are like, so fascinating. Like I alluded before about the WrestleMania fans, you know, like people came all over the world dressed like Hulk Hogan.
Yep.
It's just like, wow. You know, kids who like go out and buy basketball shoes, you know, like there's those little conventions where, you know, kids carry all these basketball shoes around.
Yeah.
And just like subcultures are just fascinating. And, you know, really, you know, it's something I need to do a little more work on.
In a place like down in Fisherman's Wharf, you're going to witness that even compounded, that the sub culture scenario, like, because if you look at all the stores, a lot of the stores, it's all the kind of knick-knack, you know, dime a piece kind of stuff, and the sweatshirts with the prison stripes and so forth.
But then there's also a store that, you know, sells 900-pound marbled polar bears or something.
Exactly.
Like, who buys that?
It's things you would be like, there is no way. But then you see this guy half an hour later rolling one down the street. Because there's always something for everybody, and that is a place that is the epic boiling pot of so much in one single 2 mile area. Because you jump off the ferry down there, you step off, you can go, you know, go right, go left. You're going to find something.
Right.
You know, and being a dead zone, yes, it is very touristy and it's very, some would say cliche. But you don't, there's few places in the nation that you're going to have that type of access in every 3 feet.
Yeah. Like in Chicago, like Millennium Park, I would go there with the bean, Strong Fountain. Yeah. That was another.
The big face.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Like that. Yeah. That was another place. It was just like chock full of tourists. And I really, I think that's the, maybe a little more Chicagoans go there because it actually is kind of entertaining.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not as, you know, because like the Wharf is just gross, really. You know, if you just go down there, it's really just gross. Yeah. It's just like everything I hate.
The
you know,
but, shit on everything.
Yeah, right, right. But like once you put a camera in my hand, I find things, you know, like I seriously, if I would rather get a full paid trip to Siberia than Hawaii. As a photographer.
Yeah.
Because I find that fascinating. And growing up on the south side of Chicago, I love industrial landscapes. I love kind of gray things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
you're a black and white photographer.
Exactly. So I think that's definitely where that came from, is growing up and where every day looked black and white, even when it was, you know, in color.
Yeah.
But yes, but you know, I'll be in Hawaii in a couple of weeks and I won't be photographing too much.
coming off that, like we were talking about where you like to shoot and you were just talking about Siberia or just, I know you just threw that out as an example, but is there any place in particular that's like your dream place to go to, like where you're really wanting to shoot at?
Wow. That's interesting.
Heavy question, huh?
Yeah. Well, I've been a lot of places, so it's weird. Like there are places I don't want to go and I don't know why. Like, and it's because of certain colors. Like I have no interest in going to India because I don't like orange. Does that make any sense?
No. It's a stylistic thing. You know that you're going to see a lot of something. Yeah. And if it doesn't fit your style, why?
But I would rather, you know, go to Russia. Yeah. I think Russia, just anything Eastern European really fascinates me. I also, I'd like to go to like Newfoundland, you know, something that's just like flat or Iceland and, you know, I don't know why I have this really fascination with places I think are barren and lonely and sad. And
The Siberia comment that you made a while ago makes more sense because, like you just said, you know, you're not exactly keen on wanting to go to India, for instance, to go shoot. But India is a very colorful, extremely vibrant type of place to go, or parts, of course. So, yeah, it wouldn't really benefit you as far as an area.
Like, I shoot a lot in black and white, but when I shoot in color, I like primary colors.
Yeah.
You know, I like red and blue, you know, and
yellow.
Yeah, but no, I don't want any orange or pink or purple. Screw that.
So it's official. Scott's not a fan of the show's colors.
Yes. Secondary colors, no, thank you.
They have mixes.
Well, I'm a big fan of red.
Yeah,
there's something red. I love red.
And downtown San Francisco, the walls, like some of the big graphics, the big 15-foot graphics along the street, reds and the colors that
blue,
you
have. Blue is my favorite, though. Give me something blue.
Yeah.
I see that by the shirt there. All right. Well, we're actually coming up. Well, we're actually beyond an hour out here. So I wanted to, unless Jim, you had anything more you wanted to throw in? Scott, is there anything more?
No, this is so much fun. I really appreciate it, guys.
It's man, our pleasure, really. Believe me.
We're very appreciative of you coming. It's and you being the one to help us kind of kick off this 2016, I'm very proud that you came into the studio.
Oh, great. I appreciate it. I had a great time.
And
thank
you're
you.
From Chicago, too, man. I tell you, man.
Yes.
What is it about us that we keep bringing Chicago?
Yeah, because we had Nima. We had Nima Taraji. You know Nima. So he was on the show.
You want to go ahead and
get
to the next
year.
One?
Oh, well, Gokhan Kurikova.
Sure.
He's going to be on in a couple of weeks.
I'm going to bring John White in, John H. White.
Oh, I would love to get John White in.
Oh, man.
If you're listening
he's
out
the
there.
Greatest.
Yeah.
He's the sweetest man ever.
I think I have a hookup with him.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know him personally, but we belong to the same photo group, the Chicago Alliance of African American Photographers. So I should think about getting John White on there.
That's everything that we do here is I know many interview types of interviews out there is like, get to the bottom of this. And it's so systematic and it's so segmented. Right. Ours is, as you can tell, it's off the cuff. We're just bullshit.
Oh, I forgot. F2.8 is my favorite, F-stop, just if you want.
F2.8?
F2.8,
uh-huh.
I can't even go down to that
notes.
With my book. Mine ends at, 3.8? But yeah, it's just having the chance just to bullshit about photography. You don't really get a chance to have that type of conversation without everybody being, we got to move on to this thing.
Yeah, it's a great community. Are there like plumber podcasts? So there's like three plumbers sitting around in Denport, Iowa, right now talking about
and five of them listening.
Probably.
That is one interesting thing about podcasts is like it is very niche. There's right. so many. There's something for everyone.
Yeah.
I think the spectrum is kind of like Fisherman's Wharf.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So, where can people find you? Where's your preferred place online?
I think probably Instagram. Mm-hmm. You know, and everything is Scott Strazanti. You know, I'm big about the branding. You got to have your name out there. So, right. so basically, I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Facebook. You know, commongroundthebook.com is where you can find my book, but, and sfgate.com, it'll be very difficult to find my photographs behind all the clickbait, but there's probably some there. So yeah, but I think Instagram is definitely where my favorite work is, and everything I shoot will bleed its way into there eventually, you know, yeah. sports photos and news photos and street photography. And like you said, my two cats will make an appearance every couple of weeks. but it's, you know, Instagram is by far my favorite. Good deal. Social media app.
I noticed with your Instagram, you have opted to not go with the wide format, the change that they made. You just stuck with the square format. Is that
just because it's all the hipstamatic.
Oh, because, like, that's right. It's specific.
So like I just shoot square photos with hipstamatic. And, and the thing I love about hipstamatic and the combination, like, I don't have to tone the photos at all. You know, they come out beautiful, you know, like when I make prints out of my hipstamatic work, they go from camera and they get printed. Like, I don't have to do any kind of, there's no Photoshop work at all. And that's
no presets or anything that you have in place.
It just like comes out with these beautiful blacks and it's just amazing.
That's an impressive. I've never used Hipstamatic myself. I use all the different other programs. I find myself using Snapseed most of the time, but that's the opposite. I'm taking something and then editing and then sharing.
Yeah. Cause I'm not into like anything except creating photographs and sharing them. You know, I don't want to spend time on Photoshop,
fiddling with it, Lightroom, and everything.
It's so boring to me. But
you are definitely a photojournalist. It's like, get the shot, get it out.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much, Jim. Let's go ahead and throw it. Where can we find you online?
Well, finally, you can find me on Instagram.
Hey.
I finally came in the 21st or the 20th century, really. And I've got on Instagram. So you can find me, Jim Watkins 113 on Instagram. And of course, jimwatkinsphoto.com on my website. And I'm all on Facebook as James Watkins, not Jim Watkins, but James Watkins on Facebook. And I'm also on Flickr. So
Excellent. With myself, you can find me at recasper.com. Same goes for Instagram. It's at recasperphoto because somebody out there took Ari Casper. If you're listening, please, can I have it? for the show, find us at streetpx.com. That's our main website. You can find our older shows. I think we are at episode eight at this point.
That's right.
So we got 7 episodes prior you can take a look at. February is going to be a very full month for us. Starting out, obviously, here today with Scott in the studio, which is a nice gift because my main man here's birthday is today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's right. Well, today when we're recording, not necessarily when you're hearing it, but
I'll have aged a few days.
Between today and when you hear this, he'll go from 21 to whatever age that Jim is comfortable throwing out there for you.
60, man.
60.
No way.
Yeah.
No.
Yes.
That's impossible.
Right?
60. Impossible.
60 years old.
Since the day I met him, I've been calling bullshit. He's He found a fountain of youth that I wish someday I might discover.
My kids are 35 and 31.
Unbelievable.
My beautiful kids, Aaron and Lauren there. Hey.
All right, well, you got to find a picture of this guy online someplace because he does not look 60. I thought he was like 42.
Yeah. Right. We were talking about GoCon earlier. We have at least 3 other people we don't really want to throw it out there just yet because we want to get everything locked in. It's going to be a full month and we look forward to sharing some more. So anyway, contact us through streetpx.com. We always love reviews on iTunes, keeps us up on the list and in between more people's ears. And thanks for sitting through our show.
Yeah, Scott, it was an absolute honor to have you on.
That was a blast.
Sorry,
I was a little chatty there.
That's perfect. We don't have to work then.
Yeah, makes our job easier. We do all the difficult work behind the curtain. Well, cool. Thanks again.
Awesome. My pleasure.
And thanks everybody for listening. We'll see you next show.
Take care.
Bye.